Session number 10699.
Brigadier Rymer Jones, Reel 23. You were telling me about the possible Arab revolt in 44.
Well, I've told you how we captured the German officer known as the Tiger, and he came in the hands of Kettling and his boys, and he was in hospital. He wasn't really sick, but it was said that he'd had an accident, motor accident, and there he was in hospital, doped by the doctors locally, and bandages and a bit of blood here and there, you see, and there he was out. Well, that was all very well because these chaps all wanted to see him, you see. They were told that he was dead. So the Bey comes to me. I said, "What is it now? What mischief are you after?" He said, "Well, look, the doctors down there are getting very excited because they say that he's liable to die." "Now, we want your permission to go on doping him for another week. No, go on doping him." So I said, "Isn't this like you, Bay? Poor old IG, if he dies, I shall take the cane, you see." I said, "All right, have another week. We'll risk it." And they all went well. And of course, the Arab side of it disappeared.
What was the idea of doping him? Could you just explain it a bit more? Was that to keep him? Was it to extract information off him, or just to?
No, it was to stop these chaps coming to him in order to rise the thing. You see, with this fellow dead, apparently, they were satisfied that it was no good going on with the rough stuff. Yeah.
What was done with him in the end?
I don't know. Well, you're just treated like a prisoner.
And another point I just wanted to ask was what was the normal police work like? I mean, you've got the sort of anti-terrorist or anti,
Well, much of the police work of the country, you see, Tel Aviv, for example, that large place was run quite differently. I went and inspected the Jewish police, the Jews, although they were nominally under me, they ran it as a separate show there, although I had my police stations also in Tel Aviv there. But what was the actual
It was
question?
actual normal sort of civilian police work. What was that like? Not connected with the Ergen or anything like that.
Well, you see, this is a good point because the place was run very efficiently, as the head of my working CID was Shawki Bey Saad. They'd been Turkish officers, and Fais Bey Idrisi. They'd been Turkish officers in the army, and then they'd come and they became part of that first part I told you, where they had security people quite different to the police, and they all came together, you see. But
Did the gathering problem, did it affect
now
this?
look, when they organized over the years and years, and you had the Daubigin and the various people of high rank coming and saying, "We'll help to, we'll write books about what they ought to do in Palestine," and so on. And it all made for greater effectiveness. Sir Herbert Daubigin, old Daubigin, my friend, he was marvelous. He wrote a complete book. They were very efficient from that point of view. The CID and so on, they were terribly efficient. And you say, what do they do otherwise? Well, you see, most of the place was open and could only be done really properly in the way we did it, and that was you had these mixed troops that went from the various big stations and called on all the mukhtars, that's the mayors of the Arab villages and so on, and dealt with the local crime and so on. And it was very effective indeed.
What were the main crimes? Were there any particular types of crime that were prevalent?
No, just the general things in that sort of country. A lot of murder. Now, the murder was... Before I gave up the prisons, I used to go around the prisons, and some of the most delightful people were the murderers. You see, they were not only apt to say, my boot hurt me, so I thought I'll kill somebody. It wasn't that sort of stuff. It was the family, the blood, which happens in all those sort of countries, you see. He killed our Bob, so we're going to kill his Bill. You know, and it went on and on and on. That's the sort of thing. They were very nice people. I'll tell you this. I went to the chief secretary's office, and there was a fellow called Chertog from the agency there. And they said that I argued with him for an hour. And he was saying, and he was quite right, of course, you see, because I was so short of men. With the PMF, we were a tremendous success. And they were frightfully short. I couldn't even have the number of companies I wanted. But the fact that I'd got chaps in the PMF and that I wasn't getting the number of recruits I wanted meant that somebody had got to fail. Either I could let the PMF get smaller and smaller, which it did, and eventually do it away with it, or I was starving the ordinary police work you talk about, which went on all the time, splendid. These were going out all the time, all over the country, daily. When I went to a station, I'd see both in Arabic and in English. And mark you, I'd got a lot of Jewish police too. I'd see the patrols for the week, and they'd go out. You see these with a sergeant in charge or an inspector, and they'd be mostly Arab as well as British police together, and they'd all go out there.
About how many on a patrol?
Half a dozen.
In a vehicle, I presume, or what would that? How would they travel?
Oh, mounted. All that outside work. I'm not talking about the inside work in the bigger towns. So, of course, they'd got all these vehicles and the PMF full of vehicles.
What was the special role of the PMF? How did they differ? How did their patrols differ from the normal patrols?
Well, they weren't doing normal police work, you see.
So their function was...
Their function was anti-terrorist. They did, in effect, do police work. Because, I mean, the nonsense didn't go on when they were around. And they went out, for instance, from Kafa Vidkin, where there was a very well-known company of mine. They had their patrols, nightly particularly, roundabout. You've got to be awfully careful. It's a very complicated show, because the Jews are very clever people. And what I'd always got to think about, if I insist on the patrols round, the Jews thinking, where are they going to patrol? It's rather like Northern Ireland. You see what I mean? So, the extraordinary part about it was that we managed to overcome our feeling. We didn't like losing men, you know, these lovely chaps going in bunches. But we managed to ride over that, and it was a very happy time. Meanwhile, the civilians, of course, they were carrying on. It was all quite normal. And they were able to do it. I couldn't get away. I was the head of bunny clubs in the Middle East. And it got away to one show where we had a mounted picnic, went out unsaddling the horses and all the rest of it, and playing mounted games on the way home. Well, I'd have loved to have done a lot of that sort of thing, but I was working from 8 o'clock in the morning.
What was your day's routine? I know it's difficult to describe a typical day. There might not have been any such thing, but what would, as IG, what was your day like? How would it start?
Well, generally, until they came to me and said, look, the men don't like it because they think you're taking unnecessary risks. I used to be collected by my car in the early morning, say at 5. And I go out and get on a horse and ride around and see the sunrise over the Transjordan Mountains and shine over Bethlehem. Then I'd come back.
You would be on your own then, would you?
I had gone out with people to start with, but then I went out on my own.
Because that's breaking your own sort of rules, isn't it?
Well, I was IG, I can do what I like. But when they said the men don't like it, I picked it up. That was in October 1945. But I was in my office by 8. I always walked there. The GOC didn't like it because he always used to go to his headquarters and the KD with a large guard around him and so on, you see. And then he saw me coming, I said, morning, General. But then, you see, we were all work. I might decide to go out and see a few stations or deal with some problem outside. But normally I'd work till 12:30. And then I might go down to the King David, not to have a drink, but to see the army. And this was a day when I wasn't doing all these outside things. And then I'd go back at about 1:30, if I'd got nothing more on, to lunch. And then I'd always, as you do in a hot country, get on my bed for 30 minutes, and I'd be back in my office at 3, and we'd be working till about 6.
What sort of, when you were in the office, what sort of work was it?
Well, will you go and ask the Commissioner of Police, the Metropolis in London, what he does when he's in his office?
So just the same sort of thing?
Well, yes, except we've got much more on, you know. And at 6 o'clock every night, I used to say that was when the alarm always went, and the bear used to come along, I'd say, what's on? He said, well, this one day we failed in a way. He said, well, all I know is there's some arms being moved down from the north, the Jews. I said, well, that doesn't help much. And that was the night when, in the middle of the night, I got a call to say that Gibbet Olga had been blown up. That was a terrific show. Terrific show. And funnily enough, marvellous fellow, he's a Southern Irishman who lives near Cork, and we would still write to each other. But he was the sergeant in charge. He was blown out of the, when the tower was, but he was blown out of the window. And he put up a marvellous show. I won't go into it now because that's another story. I keep piling one story on another.
So, at about 6 o'clock, after you'd have a sort of briefing session with Bay, what would happen after? Was that it for the day, or
what?
After your briefing session with Bay at about 6 o'clock?
Well, I was generally talking till the early hours with either my friend, the GOC's chief of staff, John Woolley. We were planning and so on, because he was a very sympathetic chap, and I was always saying to him, John, you know, you must persuade the GOC. Let us have some men. They're killing, I said. And when we got a curfew, when the High Commissioner was ambushed, and we put a curfew on, that meant to say that you'd got all sorts of our men out at night too, apart from their ordinary work. And I said, what I had to do then, as you people weren't prepared to help, I said I found all the ambulances I could, and I got police wives to volunteer and to go around to serve hot drinks and food to these men on static patrol. Static patrol, it was the same in London when I was commanding that part of the world then, and in A Division, men were all on static points at the back of the number 10 Downing Street and all these places. It's killing stuff just to stand there for hours in the dark, you know. And this is what I used to plot with John Woolley, say, how can we persuade? I must have something. The home people are letting me down. They're letting me down in Middle East. They're letting me down, and they're letting me down on my home ground while you're having a hell of a time. And Begin has said, I'm not going to touch the army while the war's on, and I'm not going to touch the civilians, only the High Commissioner and the Palestine police. And I've been having a hell of a lot of casualties, you know. Lovely men.
Were you under a lot of personal threat yourself then? Were you ever attacked?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't, but that didn't mean to say they wouldn't have liked to. But
did it restrict your social life a lot? I mean, were you restricted in what you could do in the evening?
Well, you did everything. You see, people used to... I told you, they all said, we must have normal. I said, you go and live your normal lives. You won't be touched. Begin said you won't. I said, but... I dodged in for a few minutes to a drink parties of government friends and so on, you see. And you know my story about Ben Gurion, do you? You know that he was a fellow who, when I went and shouted at him for about an hour...
Yes, you told me. Yes.
He said, well, I told you, therefore, also, when we were at a party at Government House I went to, when the Anglo-American Commission were coming out.
Yes, you...
Yes, well, there you see, I had to do all these things. In the same way you asked me why I go to all the countries round about, because I had to work with these people.
Didn't attending social events like that make it, where they were all safe, but you weren't, didn't that make you a very vulnerable target? Were you conscious that you were vulnerable?
No, I don't think so. In fact, at one time, it's a funny way things work, that the... Giles Baer came to me one day and he said, you'll be interested to hear that you and I have been taken off the list of those who were to be killed by Begin. I said, well, I've never been more insulted in my life. Is that all we're worth? You see, I said, really, what dreadful people you are. Dreadful people. I don't know, it was, I've had some fairly rousing times in my life, in war and peace, but nothing to compare with that.
You mentioned you abandoned the prisons. Could you tell me what you hadn't mentioned that before on the tape? What was your thinking behind this? What was the plan there?
Well, it's a question of principle. When I went out there as Inspector General of Police and Prisons, it had always been that, you see, since 1926. And I said, I'm not for this. And one of the first times I saw, I called on McMichael in his office for a talk. I said, I'm going to. I know it's going to take some time, sir, but I'm very much against having prisons. I said, it's altogether wrong in my view that the man who is catching prisoners and having to deal with them, many of them violent, should be the chap who's looking after them. I mean, you in prison.
So it wasn't that you got rid of the prison, you transferred the looking after them to some... I mean, the prisons continued, but they weren't under your command. They were transferred to another wing of... Is that what you mean?
Yes, well, I appointed the chaps who took it over. Very nice fellow. As a matter of fact, he got an old wound in his leg, which made him go, and they put in a fellow who I wouldn't have given house room to. He said, it is... But, you know, when Gort, High Commissioner, he knew I was getting rid of him, but he was very keen on prisons. And my latrine, he thought that was the most marvellous show, and it's a marvellous story, which I won't bore you with now. That's where we kept all the... internees, you know.
Do you want? We would be interested. Yes.
You might, but at any rate, well, I'll just tell you that when Gort came, he was a very old friend of mine. I served with him all over the place, in war too. And so he came round Jerusalem prison with me. Great big rooms, about not as broad, but half as long again, the cell, you see. He said to me afterwards, you've got three people in a cell. He said, that's all wrong, isn't it? I said, no, it actually isn't, you know. He said, I hate the whole prison idea. I like the... our own police prison, when one of our policemen had been naughty, we put him into this pleasant little take a police station, entirely for its own. And the sergeant in charge there, he works on the gardens with the prisoners. I said, that's why we're so successful, you see. I said, but I said, three in a cell. I said, you couldn't have one in a cell. I said, we're dealing with Arabs. I said, when there's a Jew, you wouldn't find we put them too many in a cell. But with the Arabs, what does the Arab do, the Arab life? He sits outside his mud hut or in the desert with his friends, and they tell each other stories. How do you imagine that we got Fitzgerald translating the Omar Khayyam, well, the Rubaiyat. Rubaiyat means verses in Persian. So he went quiet. Well, then He said, I'm coming to see Latrun, which was famous for many reasons. Before I took over, there was this great escape.
You told me about that, yes.
I told you that. Well, so he comes down there, and there was a fellow called Clothes. It was an extraordinary story. Is that all? Or? Because Clothes was brought to me, he was supposed to be rather fed up with life. And I saw this cheerful-looking creature. I said, what's barking you? He said, I don't know, things are all wrong. I said, well, look, I'm putting you in charge of Latrun. He was marvellous, this fellow. And, of course, when the police and prisons came, they took him and they made him Lord High Muckamuck in Singapore and all over the world. But at any rate, in this case, I said, you know, Lord Gort is coming round. So he said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do, sir, because, you know, these people in here, it's very easy. Life, they like it. It's like going on a holiday, really. And here it was, too. But he said, what they do is they take all the lavatory rolls and they throw the stuff all over the place. And he said, I said, well, Lord Gould will go mad if he sees that. She said, well, I'll nail them up while he's there. So Lord Gould comes down. Now, there was a Begin. His troops were the revisionists. Now, the revisionists, who had many very nice people in them, were the Jews who still thought you ought to go to the Euphrates, you know, Palestine, Redivivus. And so we had some people in there, but I don't think we ought to have had them in, really, except that you couldn't complain. And these people were the name of Pearl, who ran a little rough hotel up in Safford, that's in the northern boundary, where the Jews and the Arabs flowed round the same town, and there was very often trouble. I used to go down there. Whenever I went there, I stayed with a remarkable young man who was in the government called Peregrine. At any rate, these Pearl people had been put in one by one, the old man and then his children, into Latrun for a period. And that was the elder boy, the elder man was there when this happened. He was a very nice fellow. And so I took Lord Gort there and I said, you come round with me, you're senior prisoner, or internee. He came round and we went into a place and before we went in, Lord Gort said, have you got a library? Oh, yes, says, we've got a very nice library. So Lord Gort goes in to this big hut, you know, and he said, I expect you to do with much more books. No, we've got a very, very fine selection of books, says Pearl. So we then go to a place where there are great bins, and there's a Palestine policeman whose life is a delight in looking after all these tins of maize and God knows what, you see. So Lord, he's dazzled by this, you see. And he goes into another one, and again,